Lou Manfredini here. Do you have cracked or sunken concrete areas around your home? Call PermaSeal for a free estimate. Don't replace it, raise it. Call 800-421-7325 or visit permaseal.net.
I think now we should call Jane Goodall. Dame Jane Goodall, is that, should I say Miss Jane Goodall? Madam Jane, what is the proper way to say this?
Well, I prefer it, if it's going to be formal, that it's Dr. Jane Goodall, DBE, which is Dame of the British Empire, because, you know, that's the equivalent of a knighthood. And if you're a gentleman, you become Sir somebody. And to equate Sir with Dame, Dame is just such a silly word.
You just don't seem like the kind of girl who's a dame, you know?
That's exactly right. I hope I'm not the kind of girl who's a dame.
Was that a surprise? And that must be a great honor. And did you do that in front of the royal family? How does that work?
Well, people always lobby for, you know, their own special people to get these recognitions in the Queen's honors list. And so I did know that people were gunning for me. And it's very, very important for the Jane Goodall Institute UK. It opens new doors. So, you know, it's something that's helpful in furthering the cause.
And what is that cause in general? I mean, how did you become this person, and we'll talk about your time at Gombe and in Africa, who researched chimpanzees, who we now know so much about great apes in general, chimpanzees specifically, other animals too, because of you. But how does one go from that to being an internationally revered figure? I mean, you are that. What did the United Nations just name you?
I was named Messenger of Peace by Kofi Annan, the Secretary General, which is a huge honor. There's only 10 of us, but it's also a great responsibility, especially now. But, you know, I've been doing my best to promote peace, and we just had the UN Day of Peace, which is the 21st of September, and we flew giant peace doves all over the world, and the photographs and reports and accounts are still pouring in, and we are putting out a booklet, and it's also on our website, janegoodall.org.
Tell me more about these peace doves.
When I was made a messenger of peace, Kofi Annan pinned a little dove onto my collar, which I wear all the time, as does he.
You have it on now.
I have it on right now. And so one of our Roots and Shoots groups, this is the program for youth that's in 70 countries around the world, linked up with a group that make puppets, that's Puppet Farm Inc., and they created, in my honor, a giant peace dove made out of sheets, piece of chicken wire, and some paint, and flown on four tall poles. And then as the peace movement grew before the bombing of Iraq, other people were making these doves, other Roots and Shoots groups, and flying them when they were protesting the war. So when it came to the 21st of September, I thought, what can I do to support the UN, especially after the way it's been treated over the whole Iraq affair? And what can I do to support Kofi Annan, who I believe is the best Secretary General we've ever had, and who is such an incredible person, radiating compassion and peace and wisdom? And I thought, yes, let's have these giant peace doves, which only take 2 hours to make. They can be made from recycled materials. Let's have them flying on that day all around the world. And people became really inspired. They took them up all kinds of high places. And it's just been very inspiring to see the pictures here from the people who flew the doves and what it meant for them. So next year, I hope we'll have between 5,000 and 10,000 of the doves everywhere.
You know, when a bomb drops somewhere in the world, and it seems that happens all too often, it is, and maybe appropriately, on the front page of newspapers. This is the first I've heard of the peace doves. Does peace not get enough attention by people who do what I do, members of the press?
It really doesn't. For example, on the 21st of September, Kofi Annan, his wife, I, and the guy who created the idea of the doves, we flew one, there were two altogether, outside the UN. That didn't make the news. There were the television crews were there, and the print media was there, but it didn't emerge anywhere because it's not, you know, It was fantastic. It was joyous.
I almost believe that didn't get press attention because now you're at a point in your life where if you walk outside this building and turn the corner, you get press attention almost for being Jane Goodall. How did it come, and this is what I was asking a little earlier, from the forest of Gombe, where you're a primatologist, a researcher. Boy, we learn a lot about chimpanzees. To a world peace activist, to, if you don't mind me saying, one quite great dame, in the best of all possible ways, and someone who is really revered as a wise woman of the world by millions around the world.
It happened right here in Chicago in 1986. Dr. Paul Heltney, who at that time was director of the Chicago Academy, put on a whole four-day gathering to celebrate the publication of the first book I wrote, bringing together, I think it was 18 years of Gombe research, and it was called The Chimpanzees of Gombe. So we brought together chimpanzee researchers from right across Africa and from some captive situations, non-invasive of course. And during that four-day period, we had a session on conservation, and it was absolutely shocking. I'm seeing field researcher after field researcher showing slides and talking about the devastation of the environment where they were, talking about the snaring and the hunting. And we also had a session on conditions in medical research labs, training of circus chimps and so forth. So that I went into that conference planning to return to Gombe, continue to collect data and analyze it, which I love doing. But I came out as an activist. I knew I couldn't any longer sit in the forest knowing that, you know, what had taken me to where I was in my career was at risk, and the creatures who taught me so much were disappearing and being horribly badly treated. So it was, I always liken it to St. Paul on the road to Damascus. It was a complete shock, and it totally changed me.
I want to talk about that more. In the time we've been talking here, about 7 minutes, if I could do some fast math, at least one dog or cat in the Chicago area has been euthanized, or no, killed at a shelter because a home can't be found. Multiply that out in the country, I don't know how many, maybe 50, maybe 100 have been killed just in the time, and it's been a short time that we've talked here.
Take it around the world, and it's even more.
Right. If we can't care for our own pets who we say we love, how are we going to make that leap to chimpanzees or dolphins or other animals that we might see on Animal Planet, but we don't know personally like we do the animals we love? Do you think not enough emphasis is placed on this?
I think that our dogs and cats are immensely valuable as teachers. When I first went to Cambridge University, I'd been for 1.5 years with the chimpanzees. I had no degree of any sort, and Louis Leakey, my mentor, said I had to get a degree, otherwise I would never be able to stand on my own 2 feet, and he wouldn't be around to get money, but I did need a degree. No time for a BA, he said, you have to go straight for a PhD. So I got to Cambridge and quite excited, you know, to learn about how to express all this in scientific terms. And I was told I'd done it all wrong. I mean, it was almost a hostile environment. I should have not named the chimps. I should have numbered them. I couldn't talk about their personalities, their minds, or their emotions. Those were unique to us. I was guilty of, you know, the worst anthropomorphic sin, attributing human characteristics to non-human creatures.
Now, is that because in their eyes you were a woman? Because back then, women didn't do the kind of research that you did. Or is it because you just did that?
It was because I just did that. And although I should have been overawed by these erudite scientists, first of all, by the time I got there, I was 27, so I was, you know, not just a malleable youth. But secondly, my whole childhood I had a wonderful teacher who taught me that animals have personalities, minds, and feelings, and that was my dog, but also my cat And the two guinea pigs, my sister and I had a guinea pig each. And anybody who's had a dog or a cat or a horse or who's had a relationship with a cow or a pig, you know, everybody knows animals have personalities, minds and feelings. So I knew the chimpanzees did, and I knew on this count anyway, these professors were wrong.
Tell me, was it your dog that convinced you that these professors were wrong? I mean, certainly the chimps and the different personalities that you saw that we got to know through your television specials, that must have convinced you. But was it at some basic level your dog? And if so, tell me about your dog, what your dog's name was, and about the personality of your dog.
I think the point was that I was already convinced by my dog before I ever got to Gombe. And my dog was called Rusty. He was my childhood companion. He didn't even belong to us. He belonged to a hotel around the corner, but they kind of didn't care about him. And so we didn't even feed him. They fed him. He would arrive at 6 in the morning, bark outside the door, come up to me, was with me all day, except when he trotted off for his lunch, using his owners as a hotel, in fact. And I've had dogs my whole life. I can't have one now. I'm traveling 300 days a year. But of all the dogs I've known, Rusty was so intelligent. He was really unusual. I think he was sent to me as a messenger from the animal kingdom.
You write about that frequently in your books, about different people or different animals that have been sent to you. What can we all learn about our dogs that maybe we're taking for granted at home, or maybe even if we don't take them for granted, what can we learn from them?
We can learn so much about unconditional love, and we can learn how they can comfort us when we're sad. They seem to sense it. One of my Roots and Shoots groups in England has a very wise coordinator, and he got all the kids in this class to go home and for 2 weeks, for at least half an hour a day, to carefully watch whatever pet they had in the house or companion animal. And if they didn't have one, they should watch a bird or something in the garden. And I was there when the kids reported on the result of this experience, and one and all were absolutely amazed and said things like, you know, I never thought I could be interested for half an hour while my dog was asleep, but I watched how he seemed to sense things in his sleep through his nose and through his ears. And another one said, well, I had two dogs and I knew they were different, but I didn't realize that they were completely different or why they were different. And so this little lesson really helped these kids to understand how amazing these companion animals are.
We don't have to live with dogs or cats or companion animals. No one forces us to do that. Why do you think, as a society, the Western world by and large, why do you think we make that choice?
I think there's a long tradition in human beings going back to probably when the first wolves were tamed or the jackals in Africa, that we need this companionship and this special relation with an other than human. And it's now been proven that dogs actually can heal people, that they actually affect the physiology of a sick or a distressed person, that they actually bring new life to the elderly who perhaps haven't spoken for several years. They've retreated into their own world, and yet take a dog, take a cat, and you see them slowly coming back to life. So I don't think we yet totally understand the mystery of this relationship, but more and more people are pursuing it now. And I mean, this even goes to the extent that there appears to be a telepathy, so that dogs will know when their owners are coming home.
Yeah, you know, I work with an animal-assisted therapy group here in Chicago. I'm on their board, and it's one of the more progressive animal-assisted therapy groups, one of the most well-known in the country. I could tell you story upon story upon story that would even amaze you. Well, maybe not you, but pretty close to them, and touch you. And what convinced me, I was there doing a story, and I was not necessarily surprised, but touched at what I saw. And you can't go to one of the sessions and not see some sort of miracle happen at some level. Whether it's the person who had brain damage and no one could understand this person, family members couldn't either, so he tended not to say anything, of course. And when he did, it was just garbled. By the end of the session with this one dog, he had the dog sitting, laying down. Now, to me, it sounded like, rah, you know, it was sad to listen to. But this dog somehow got it. No hand signals, no anything else. How did this dog understand? You know, or the dog that wiggled our little dog, it's her way into this little boy's heart, who was afraid to use his voice. He had some kind of surgery. The therapist said he could. They tried to over and over. Their efforts completely failed, but it became fun to work with our dog. And at first he was actually afraid of the dog. Even though it's a little dog, he was afraid of the dog. And once this dog, it wasn't me, it wasn't my wife, it was our dog who said, trust me, and formed a relationship by making this little boy laugh, then he began to say, okay, come, Lucy. Well, the whole goal at the end of 8 weeks, a gymnasium-sized room, for him to call the dog from the other side of the room. Well, our poor, exhausted dog, by the end of this one session, it was, Lucy, come, Lucy, come, Lucy, come, Lucy, come, the whole time. And I have 80 or 90 or 100 stories like that, and anyone who works with animal-assisted therapy does. It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. I know. I mean, I've read countless stories. I've met people. But just to give an example of how far science still has to come to even admit some of these things happen. They did a study which showed that a cat's purr actually is beneficial for the cat. So this is why this is why we talk about a cat having 9 lives. The purring actually is good for healing bones. It's good for various things. So what do the scientists decide to do? They decide that they will make a machine that replicates the frequency of the cat's purr. And they seriously and solemnly think that that machine is going to do the same for someone who's suffering, who's hurting, as a living, warm, breathing cat, which is so much more than its purr. It really shocks me.
Do you think your colleagues are still... Now, having said that, medical doctors now prescribe. I've seen it. These are not Looney Tune doctors in California. These are real doctors, like the head of the Mayo Clinic, who, former head of the Mayo Clinic is one of them, writes on a prescription pad, you need this medication for this blood clot problem you have because you just had heart surgery, and you need this sort of heart medication too, and get a puppy, mm-hmm. and writes it on a prescription pad, get a puppy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But, you know, the doctors aren't the ones who are prescribing machines instead of cats. That's at a different level of science, you know, behind the lab door and the white coat sort of image.
So how important is it that we understand and connect and maybe better treat our companion animals?
Certainly better treat, better understand. Lots of people have wonderful understanding at a certain level. People buy companion animals without thinking it through. They can't really care for them. Think of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of dogs who are left early in the morning. Their owner comes back late at night. And, you know, that isn't a life for a dog. So you need to be able to care for the animals. You need to understand them better. And you need to watch them. And you need to realize all the little signals they give you for what they want or don't want, other than the sort of accepted ones, you know, wagging tail, barking, and so forth. There's so many other little ways in which they can tell you what they want.
Or cats, too, I presume. Now, you're the one, and it was your power of observation. And I read that Leakey chose 3 women, you and Baruta Galdikas for the orangutans, and Diane Fossey to watch gorillas, because he thought you would be committed longer to the project, but he also thought that a female's powers of observation are stronger than a male. Is that true? I mean, did Leakey think that was true? Do you think it's true, I suppose? But also then tell me, as a scientist, you're an observer anyway, regardless of whether that's true or not, some of these things that we might be missing in our own pets at home.
Well, first of all, Lewis truly believed that women made better observers. I think that there is a certain level where women allow themselves to be more intuitive. And I think that's a really important part of learning to understand the behavior of animals. And it's said that you need to be objective as a scientist, but as far as I'm concerned, you can be totally objective and at the same time be feeling empathy. And I think possibly from an evolutionary standpoint, there are certain advantages that may be built into a woman. One, if you watch chimpanzees, to be a good mother, you have to be patient. So possibly patience is something that's been built into the female psyche. I don't know if that's true, but if it is, that would be a big benefit for somebody learning about animals. Secondly, mothers have to understand the wants and needs of their children before they can speak. So you are attuned to these kinds of signs and signals. And thirdly, traditionally, women have they've played a role in the family that's depended on looking for these little relationships between people. And, you know, if Uncle Tom is in a bad mood, don't let little Billy go anywhere near him. Keep them away. Keep the peace within the family. Watch for the little signals. Watch for them in your own children. So that also would be very beneficial for somebody studying animals.
And after all, they say that our domestic dogs and cats are, in a sense anyway, versions of wolves as wolf cubs, is that right?
Wolf cubs.
Yeah, and the same with cats. They're kind of like baby tigers in sort of kind of a way. All right, so what are we missing? What are our cats or dogs trying to tell us that we're not picking up on, do you think?
I think it's, you know, we've become further and further and further separated from the natural world. And if you talk to some of the indigenous people, their children grow up playing outside in the grass, and there's usually some kind of animal that they play with. And I think that as so many children are brought up in environments that are totally different, they are very hygienically sealed off from the natural world, which is a tragedy. And I think that psychologically, for healthy psychological development, a child needs to be out in nature. And at least if they have a dog or a cat or something else in the house, then that is one way of getting back that lost connection.
You know, I've said that in our concrete world, we're yearning our natural world in ways we don't even know or understand. And that might be one reason why we're seeing an increase in the reptiles being kept as pets, or some of these other exotic animals being kept as pets, or even the fact that the dog numbers and the cat numbers have never been so high. I mean, there are more companion animals today in America, and I know the same is true in many countries in Europe, as ever before in history. Do you think that's one reason why?
I know, I would suspect, just as a gut feeling, having not really thought about it, that the reason for the cat and dog numbers to go up is different from some of these exotic animals, because I'm pretty sure from some of the people I've met who have exotic animals, that's a sort of bragging rights for them. They want something dramatic. They want to be able to say, you know, come and see my tiger. Or come and see my, you know, chimpanzees, our closest living relatives, can still be bought and sold legally. And it's absolutely shocking. You can buy them on the internet. And like tigers, chimpanzees grow up, and when they get to 6 or 7, they're now dangerous. They're potentially dangerous. They can bite. They don't want to be like a human child in a human house. They're chimpanzees. They have their own life. And so they become increasingly likely to resent discipline, to bite. And what happens to them? Well, the zoos don't want them. They don't know how to behave like ordinary chimpanzees. They disrupt a captive group. So unless you can find a sanctuary that's prepared to slowly enable them to find their chimpanzee nature again, they've been ending up in medical research labs in 5-foot by 5-foot cages.
Yeah, it's pretty sad. You wrote about that in one of your books, didn't you?
Visions of Caliban, that I did with Dale Peterson. And yes, this explored what happens to chimpanzees used in medical research. It explores the usually cruel training of chimpanzees used in any form of entertainment, circuses or any kind of advertising or movies.
Now, it so happens that a story came out recently about how smart our dogs are. And then I'll get off the dog thing. And that their genetic code is far more closely aligned to ours than we ever thought. More closely than a domestic rat, for example. Not as close as chimpanzees. And I bring it up because you're the one who helped us learn about how close we are genetically to chimpanzees. Who do you think are the most intelligent of animals out there? If we could do a David Letterman list, but maybe only five instead of 10, what do you think the most intelligent animal on Earth is? Maybe the fifth most intelligent, or we could start with the first most, it doesn't matter.
Well, first of all, it depends on how you define intelligence, but I assume that now we're talking about a human type of intelligence, problem solving, and that kind of thing, rather than brilliant adaptation to a natural environment.
Well, you know, someone did a book about the intelligence of dogs. That was the name of the book. I thought it was a horrible, I respect the author, know him, thought it was a horrible book, because how do you compare a beagle, which by the way it's built and its very nature, what it was bred to do, is going to sniff somewhere. If you have if right now I put a blanket on the ground and put some treats in the blanket and put 50 blankets over that blanket, a beagle would find it. Some other breeds might not, including the breed that he says is the most intelligent, the Border Collie. So you're right. I mean, the definitions of these sorts of things are difficult, aren't they?
Still, if we let's for the moment, so that we can actually come up with some with some creatures.
We need to.
Let's say we're talking about problem solving, and we'll say dogs, whether they solve the problem by their nose or by their sight, but we're really thinking about the way the brain works and solving problems of the kind of probably stupid variety that we give to animals. From their point of view, they're probably dumb problems, but anyway, I would.
But what do you mean by that? Like, I don't know, setting up a rat maze to measure intelligence of rats. Do you think rats, if they could articulate it, would say, "Boy, that's pretty stupid"?
Yeah, I'm sure they would. But you know, I think the great apes, we say they're highly intelligent because their brains work most like ours. The anatomy of their brain is more like ours.
So number one on the list would be the great apes. Could we be more specific? Would you say the chimp, the bonobo, the gorilla, orangutan?
Chimpanzees and bonobos and gorillas and probably orangutans. It honestly depends on the different tests you give them. But all of them can learn American Sign Language. All of them can use those signs to communicate with each other. All of them can solve quite sophisticated problems. The chimpanzee and the bonobo have been used far more often. You find levels of ability to solve problems in individuals.
Now, they can't do algebra, but so what do you mean by problem solving? An example that might come to my mind, because I spent some time in Borneo, so orangutans are close to my heart, is zoos for a long time had a problem keeping them because they were able to find their way out. They could pick a lock. They could get through and over things people never thought they could. Give me an example for each of these as to what you mean by problem solving.
Well, problem solving, and let's just stick to the chimpanzee now so we won't get through our list of intelligent animals, but there's a chimpanzee called Ai in Japan. She's been working with Professor Matsusawa since she was 1.5. She's hooked on her computer like kids are hooked on video games. She learns the most complex problems. She has to count up the number of dots on one side of a screen, a double-screened panel, and she has to then press the corresponding number on the other side. She has to replicate a list of 5 numbers on this side, on the other side. As soon as she presses one number, the screen goes dead, so she's got to remember. She has to also find ways of learning these different problems. And to watch her is absolutely amazing. And she's, her mind is clearly working in the same kind of way as ours, but much faster. Much faster.
Do you think we still don't give all of the great apes combined enough credit for how smart they are? By we, I mean popular culture, and I guess I also mean science.
Yeah, I think people would be amazed if they knew quite how smart the great apes are. I mean, you know, they work problems out from even in the wild. A new like one chimpanzee male way back when, I offered him a banana by hand for the first time, and he was scared to take it. So he made a threat gesture, which was shaking a little bunch of grass. One of the stems of the grass hit the banana. Instantly, you saw the light bulb go off. He dropped the grass, reached around, picked a piece of twig, dropped it, looked around, picked a stick, knocked the banana from my hand. So that was this smooth processing of an accidental sort of, innate pattern leading to a brand new solution for a brand new problem. That's a really good example of how the apes solve problems.
One more thing about chimpanzees in particular. There are wars that chimpanzees engage in. Is intelligence in some ways not always the best of things?
Well, chimpanzees like us seem to live in a society where power is rewarding for its own sake. And so you get these contests between the males for dominant status. But the war, in quotes, the four-year war, seemed to be a very simple fighting over territory to gain increased resources for your own females and young, which is a very human characteristic. And it's a very timely reminder that if we want world peace, which everybody is striving for and which seems to be slipping ever faster from our grasp, we have to learn to live in harmony with the natural world. If we put down all our guns today, there will be wars over water because we're damaging our water supply.
So we've got the great apes as number one on our list. What would be number two?
Number one in that they're using the brain more like ours, so that it's very easy for us to measure intelligence because it's the way we use our brains. But then coming way up high and probably just as, if not more intelligent, we have the whales, the great whales and the dolphins. And I'm not an expert on this, but their ability to communicate, their compassion and empathy, and I find them absolutely, totally fascinating. And I'd love to spend more time studying how their minds work.
They certainly have an ability to learn. Otherwise, we wouldn't see them in these shows that we see them in, correct?
And we should not see them in shows. I think one of the most cruel things is to keep dolphins and whales in, even if it's a big oceanarium. They need to be out there. They need to be free. And pray God that the ban on the Navy using low-frequency sonar as a defense in the sea, is the ban remains in place, because that is so devastating, not only to whales and dolphins, but other marine creatures as well.
Now, I must ask you, what is the difference between keeping a chimpanzee group in a zoo, or you name the animal, it doesn't matter, and any of the cetaceans, the whales or the dolphins?
The whales and the dolphins cover vast distances, and to keep them in a small enclosure going around and around, their communication covers vast distances, and this confinement is destroying their being, according to the people who really know. Chimpanzees, if you give them a big space with a very enriched environment, and you continually offer them challenges, how to get their food and so on, you give them opportunity to get out of sight, you leave them with their babies, then, you know, if I compare the life of a chimpanzee in the wild today, people are setting snares, the habitat is disappearing, logging companies make roads, chimpanzees are facing extinction in most of the countries where they live.
So you don't buy the fact that the ones at the zoos are ambassadors, so to speak?
The dolphins and the whales. You know, there are damaged dolphin and whales, and I absolutely agree that people do get a good feeling from looking at these captive dolphins, but to go and actually catch one, to destroy its relationship with its family, is intensely cruel. Elephants is another example. of animals that never ever should be in zoos, unless they have huge areas to roam and deep, deep pools to swim in, because they love water and they need water.
And often I see elephants in zoos and it's one elephant or an Asian elephant with an African elephant, and that's not anywhere near how they live and need to live, really, because they're so social. Are elephants next on your list by any chance? Have we made a transition there? What would be next on your list?
Certainly, elephants are amazingly intelligent. They're long-lived. They have complex brains. Again, I haven't studied elephant intelligence. They love making paintings like chimpanzees do. So, you know, they're way up there.
You know, when you read the definitions of intelligence, I've never read ability to make art or wanting to make art ever. But yet human cultures have done that from the very, very beginning. Do you think that is a sign of intelligence, and the fact that the great apes and elephants seem to actually enjoy this speaks well of their intelligence?
Yes, because it's a playfulness, and play is an example. Imaginative play is an example of intelligence in human society anyway. And, you know, the fact that they can use some object and make patterns, and that these patterns will vary according to their mood, it just seems that it's something outside the box, so to speak, and that it's playful and it's curious and it's probably fun.
Mm-hmm. You must have had one-on-one sort of encounters with elephants in Africa. What, aside from what you've said, give me an example of their intelligence in the wild. We now know about their infrasonic communication and how they communicate with other elephants that are distances away that they cannot see. It's like the elephant version of using a cell phone, except their long-distance charge isn't as expensive as ours.
Yeah, it's the same as the whales and the dolphins, the same kind of long-distance communication. Examples of intelligence, they use tools in the wild. They get together to try and help injured companions. They've got great empathy and compassion, I think. But again, you know, I haven't studied elephants.
They seem to understand death in some way we don't understand, correct?
That's how it seems, that they find bones of dead elephants and they seem to recognize that these are elephants and show some kind of grief. They bury dead companions. Chimpanzees do not. So in some ways, you know, this is what's so fascinating about animals. There are little bits of different animals that we really empathize with. And even though chimpanzees are so close to us, there are ways in which perhaps we don't like it. It's too much like looking at ourselves. We see all our bad qualities in the chimpanzees and less of our bad qualities in elephants.
Interesting. I wonder if that's one of the reasons why we don't like wolves at all. I don't know.
Wolves are probably, people who study wolves, people who know wolves, say that there you have a more alert, a more imaginative mind than a dog. And I'm not going to go there, down that road.
Right, right.
I mean, dogs taught me so much. Dogs can be, I think, uncannily intelligent. They can show great empathy.
Would dogs and cats be next on your list? Or what would be next?
Well, I've got to go to parrots. Now, here we have a creature with a brain that's so different. But I know a parrot in New York called Nkisi. Nkisi has just...
Can you spell that? Do you know?
N-K-I-S-I. He has a website. He belongs to an artist. He's captive bred. He was selected after a 4-month search from the people who breed captive parrots, and I'm not going to talk about whether that's right or wrong. Certainly better than getting them from the wild.
Oh yeah.
He's just been credited with 971, I think it is, words. He isn't counted as having a new word until he's used it at least 5 times in a proper context. In other words, if he just repeats a word, that doesn't count. Before I met him for the first time, his owner, Amy, she was showing him lots and lots of pictures of me and chimps. He'd never said chimp. When I walked into the room, he said, "Got a chimp?" This when she makes jewelry, she broke a necklace. He flew over and he looked down. He said, "What a pity you broke your nice new necklace." He uses grammar. He initiates conversations. And he apparently has this uncanny ability to know what she's thinking, even if she's in a completely different part of the house. And this has been, you know, rigorously tested by Rupert Sheldrake, who wrote The Dog Who Knows When His Master's Coming Home.
Right. You know, it reminds me of an avian behaviorist who told me about a parrot belonging to, in fact, someone who used to work at some sort of high level for Ronald Reagan. And the television was left on for this bird, which is what this owner liked to do. And it was the night Princess Diana was killed. And he comes home. And, you know, they kept showing it over and over and over and over and over again. And he comes home and he was not aware of what happened. And he walks into the room and the parrot turned to him and said, "Very sad, very sad, very sad, very sad." They, do you think, understand more than we give them credit for? And certainly that they're not just, quote, parroting. You know, they know what they're saying.
Well, certainly Nkisi does. I've been bowled over by this bird, going in with a bunch of flowers for Amy because it's Mothering Sunday. And Nkisi is there as we come through the door. So there are the flowers, but also Amy has offered a cup of tea. And Nkisi, and she very often greets people by making smoke from sage, you know, a Native American thing. So Nkisi starts on her in a bullying kind of way. There he is, up on top of his cage, where he likes to be. And he says, flowers, water for the flowers. And she's doing the flowers, and he says, put the kettle on, make the water. And then he says, and the smoke, do the smoke. She says, "Nkisi, I can't do three things at once. I'm doing making the water for the tea. Well, water for the flowers, and make the smoke. And as soon as she's done one task, he quits. And it's quite extraordinary to see and hear.
Yeah, I presume that's an African gray parrot. I guess I can go to the web. It is. Okay.
You know, Nkisi is the only creature I know who can actually use grammar in the way that a child might. Like he said the other day, "Jane flied over the sea." So he's using the past in the wrong way, just as a child might.
Do you think that some owners of some parrots, it depends on the species of bird, could get more out of their birds if they worked with them in a closer way? Or do you think this is just one darn brilliant bird and the exception rather than the rule?
No, I don't think he's an exception. I think the thing is, Amy never taught him like people teach parrots. She'd never sit him in front of something that went on and on and round. She treats him just as though he's a small child. And he has the kind of toy boards that young children have, and he can make things, play on them. And then he'll come up to Amy and say, the whatever board it is needs a new battery, and he even pretends to put a battery in. He does imaginative play.
Imaginative play, not too different than the kind of art we were talking about. Some of these animals all have something in common. Okay, that's number four. What would be number five?
We've had five, haven't we?
Well,
we've had the great apes.
Right.
We've had whales and dolphins. We've had elephants. We've had parrots, and we've had dogs and wolves.
Oh, okay. I didn't know dogs and wolves were.
I find them so amazing. For me, there's something about a dog. People say, "What's your favorite animal?" I suppose it's a chimpanzee. No, it's a dog.
Now, you know, the cat lovers are going to be writing us now. Dogs more than cats, or do you think they're about the same?
I think cats are probably about the same. I've had both. They're just so different. You know, they're rather like the difference between a gorilla and a chimpanzee. A chimpanzee is an extrovert. They want to please. They kind of show off. And the gorillas are more introspective and don't really care what you think about them. And that seems to be like many cats, although there's amazing exceptions.
So do you think we're going to call this a tie for fifth place? And have dogs and cats be at the same level? I'm trying to help you out here.
Yeah, no, I don't know. I don't know enough about cats. But from what I know of what people have said and what I've read, cats might even be smarter than dogs. It's just that they don't want to please us the way dogs do.
Well, they don't want to tell us how smart they really are. I will tell you when I go to veterinary conferences, because I talk about feline enrichment, in fact, to veterinarians. I begin by asking, who do you think is smarter, dogs or cats, or are they about the same? And every single time, more vets and vet techs raise their hand for cats, for what that's worth.
Well, cats know when they're going to be taken to the vet.
Oh, yeah.
And, in fact, most vets who were asked in London said they no longer make appointments for cats. They just say, bring him in when you can. And, you know, this ties in with Rupert Sheldrake's study on the dog knowing when his master's coming home, the cat knowing when he's going to be not stroked and petted and cuddled, but taken off to the veterinarian. But we've missed out one of the most intelligent animals.
What is that?
The pig. Absolutely. Pigs have even been taught to use cursors on computers and solve problems that way. Pigs who've been pets, they're just so intelligent. And when we think how we treat pigs, the ones who are slaughtered for people to eat, it makes you sick to your stomach. And when you think how a dog relies on the sense of smell, and think, wouldn't it be magic if for just a few minutes you could feel the world the way the dog does through scent? Pigs' noses are even more sensitive. And they're kept in these stinking hog farms. They have to breathe in ammonia. They can't walk. Their legs break. And their brains are as intelligent as an intelligent dog. And that's what we do to them.
Are you a vegetarian?
Yes.
You know, if you could choose one animal, because you talk about this in your talks, that we should put us in their place, and deep down inside, wouldn't it be exhilarating to be a dolphin and be able to communicate with the other dolphins, or a bird, and use various examples? What would you be?
I think I would have to say a chimpanzee, just because...
What a surprise!
Well, just because I've spent my whole life trying to learn their secrets, and I know I never can, but if I could get into their mind just for a few minutes, you know, many of the last sealed doors would be open.
Now, you're with Animal Planet. Congratulations. What are some of the shows? You've got three of them coming up. The first one will be The Best of Jane Goodall, and sort of a behind-the-scenes look at some of the things that have never aired on your other specials. Am I right?
They're calling it a retrospective, and it's a look at Gombe, and the team came to Congo, Brazzaville, where we have our largest chimpanzee orphanage for youngsters whose mothers have mostly been killed for the bushmeat trade, but there isn't enough meat on a baby chimp. So they filmed me there. And they filmed me getting this incredible Spanish prize that I'm about to go and collect, the Prince of Asturias Prize. It's the biggest thing in the Spanish calendar. It's their equivalent of a Nobel Prize, and it's going to open the doorway for us into Latin America. It's very exciting. So they filmed what the Spanish ambassador did in Dar es Salaam. He brought over two Spanish people, one who's a tenor, one who's a pianist, and put on this incredible event to celebrate this prize.
Do you think that people realize how desperate it is, not only for chimpanzees, orangutans, they're on an island, they have nowhere to go. The mountain gorillas, in a sense, are on an island. They're on the tops of these mountains. They can't even get to the other gorillas to spread the genetic pool. Are people aware of how desperate things are?
I think people are not aware. And how many people are aware that if we can't do something desperate for the Gombe chimpanzees, these famous individuals, they are on the brink of a point of no return. They are isolated on an island. But we have hope for them, because it's very clear that if you don't involve the local people, if you don't get them on your side, if you don't help them to lead better lives, these people living in abject poverty, I mean, less than a dollar a day. And once you do, and we have a program called Take Care, which is now in 33 villages around Gombe, and we've now got to the stage where we are persuading many of these villagers to stop hacking at the tree stumps that once were there. So leafy forests are growing up in 5 years, 20-foot-high trees. And this, for the first time, gives us hope that we can create corridors so that the chimpanzees can move out of Gombe and others can move in, as is their typical pattern.
How important is ecotourism in all this to say now people were going to see the gorillas and then the political climate made it more difficult. Now people are starting again to do that with, they feel, relative safety. I'm not sure. The orangutans are just physically very difficult, at least for Americans or the British to get to because of where it is in the world. But again, even if you could get there, there's a real concern about safety. And where the chimpanzees are located, it isn't all too different either. Would bringing in ecotourism help, or do you think that's not necessarily a part of the answer?
It depends totally on the country. But, for example, the greatest threat to the chimpanzees, gorillas, bonobos in Central Africa, which is the heartland of their surviving significant populations, is the bushmeat trade. That's the commercial hunting of wild animals for food. And everything, elephants, gorillas, chimpanzees, bonobos, antelopes, birds, bats, everything shot, smoked, sun-dried, and taken not to feed starving people, but to the urban elite who will pay more for a piece of bushmeat than they will for a piece of goat or chicken. And the problem here is the logging companies making roads deep into the heart of the forest, which for the first time gives access to the hunters.
But if there is no demand for these items, then the hunters won't be, as I presume, motivated. So how do you lessen demand?
Well, first of all, it's a lot of education, because the people living in the urban areas are people who a little while before were probably living out in the forest. And, you know, we have to start massive education. But the good news is that President Bongo of Gabon just agreed to create 13 new national parks. And these will be for tourism. And because of his leadership in this, the Congo Basin Forest Partnership is working with six of the countries which comprise the Congo Basin. And they have all bought in theoretically to a plan which says, well, let's think about ecotourism as a sustainable way of bringing in foreign exchange in place of selling off all our forests to the logging companies, which is not sustainable.
That takes an awful lot of willpower to do. I mean, in this country, if you look at the percent of national park and resources we have, it is less, in fact, than many African countries that we so easily criticize.
I know, it makes me really angry. We are so hypocritical. We sit in a glass house and throw stones around the place. And I mean, it's just, if you look at the state of the environment today and the effect that elite societies, as is exemplified by the United States, the damage that's being done by those elite societies who all have more than they need. I do. I have masses of stuff I don't actually need. So do you. And when we get to the very wealthy with their three houses and their three or four cars, you know, the resources on the planet are finite, and some of these lifestyles are absolutely not sustainable. And then on the other hand, you have people living below the poverty line whose numbers are increasing all the time. They can't plan their lives. The women are not educated. And it's a very terrifying world that we face today.
Is that the biggest problem in the world, do you think? That there are too many haves and way too many have-nots?
The fact
that there's such a distinction between them. There increasingly is no in-between.
Absolutely. This is really it. One, overall, we have too many people. Two, we have far, far too many of the elite because of the demands they make on the natural resources. And we have far, far too many of the people in the developing world living in poverty, because they have to destroy the environment to live. All they can do is cut down some more forest to grow some more food to feed the family. They can't plan their family. They don't have the wherewithal to plan their families. And how can you plan a family when about 30% of your children die before the age of one? And then you've got all the epidemics, the AIDS epidemic. You've got cholera that keeps appearing. You've got a lack of health care. So this is why we're now ready to replicate our Take Care program in other countries to try and address this crippling poverty and at the same time provide education. And this is why our Roots and Shoots program for youth, which is now in 70 countries around the world and has members from preschool through university and beyond, and is helping young people to make the world a better place for animals, for people, and for the environment we all share.
You know, you talk about signs a lot. You did today. This morning when I was out walking my dogs, I found this. And I thought of you immediately because it made me think, what could this have belonged to? It wasn't a pigeon. And this is big city Chicago. What little bird? It's a yellow feather with black tipping. What could that be? Do you think there is a lot of wildlife all around us that if we just opened our eyes, we would see? And those of us who live in urban areas, which is now most of America, it's there, but we're not even seeing what is there. So much isn't there, but that there more might be more there than we think.
One, I think there's more there than we think. Two, we can encourage it, and this is the way into the future, to allow urban areas to have patches of land where you can have wildlife, so that we can live in harmony, so that city kids can get this feeling of being in nature. And, you know, I think a wonderful example is the Peggy Notabart Museum, which is restoring the riverbank there to what it used to be. And there are these areas like that.
And they do bring kids out to the prairie area in school groups, and they look at all the plants that are indigenous to our area, and then all the things that they bring. And they do bring them. It's amazing that nature just appears somewhere, with a little help, out of nowhere. If children did this, even in big cities, Boston, New York, Los Angeles, San Diego, Detroit, trying to name cities my column is in as well, but all over the country, Houston, do you think that little bit here, the little bit there, the little bit there, would really make a difference?
I know it would. And there was a study done in Chicago. I have no idea who did it. And then it was replicated in other places. But they took areas of very high crime and they divided them. And one half, they greened. They worked very hard and they changed vacant lots into places where there were growing things. They put in lots of window boxes. They hung baskets. And the others they left. And the rate of crime dropped by about 50% where they put the green. People have this, there's something, and I don't think anybody studied it. We don't know why we psychologically need the green and the nature and the feeling anyway of being back in touch with the natural world.
That's so interesting, and I'm not necessarily surprised by that. Probably my guess is the kids were involved in all that. How many Roots and Shoots programs are there now in the world? And not that you counted, but give or take, how many kids are involved?
Well, we believe there's approximately 5,500 groups. And if we average out a group at, say, 30, you do the math, because we don't know. We're trying to get a handle on the number of kids. But 5,500 groups with a sort of average of 30, because sometimes it's a whole school, like in mainland China, Tanzania. Sometimes it's just a small group that meets after school. But we're working now to get Roots and Shoots philosophy into a lot of the curricula so that you just get the feeling of caring about the world around you, into math, into history, into geography.
Let me ask the question you don't want to hear. In a lot of Middle Eastern countries right now as we speak, the kids are being taught to fight. They're being taught that it's honorable to kill yourself for a cause. In America, right down the street from where we are speaking now, we're speaking in a very nice neighborhood, but just right down the street, dogs are being used for dog fighting, and there are kids growing up, that's all they see a dog for example. They've never been to the zoo, maybe, or if they have, they taunt the animals while they're there. There must be another side of you, or maybe not, because you are just the most optimistic person, but you must see these things that are happening. Does it bother you?
Well, of course it bothers me. Why else am I traveling 300 days a year and growing roots and shoots everywhere? And we've been incredibly successful in the inner city. And the animal is part of it. We've been incredibly successful in China, where everybody says, well, you can't have much impact in China because their culture is cruel to animals. If you get children and you introduce them to animals, and this is what we're doing, then you find there's no innate cruelty. The Chinese and the inner city kid, the African, the Indian, the white child, they're born with the same propensity to love animals.
You know, what you just said is so interesting. You know, I would give tours at the Lincoln Park Zoo, just down the street from here, and we'd have groups with kids, and when there were no adults around, it was better. And the younger the kids, it was better. And it didn't matter what animal you pulled out of your pocket, whether it was a snake or a little bunny rabbit, their eyes would widen, and it wasn't with fear, it was with wonder. What do you think it is about kids and animals?
I don't know what it is, except that we need animals. Why we need animals, I don't know that anybody's come up with an answer for that.
Am I right about this sort of, we're almost born with this wonderment of the world around us?
I think we're born with a wonderment, and then, you know, if that is encouraged in a child, then it develops into a humane attitude towards animals, which we all know helps us to become better people. And I think there's one school or a center really for children who are right at the end of any possibility in normal schools. They've been through the school system and they're ready to go into the underworld or jail for life. And this school matches up each child with an animal on a farm.
In New York.
It's
or
Connecticut.
It's in New England. I know the guy
who
does it. Yes.
That's right. Sam Ross.
Right, yes.
Yes, Green Chimneys.
Yes, yes.
Unbelievable what these animals do for these children. The children, for the first time, find that they can bond with a creature that won't tell on them, won't give them away, won't let them down, is always there for them. A creature into which they can pour their inmost secrets. And it's just, it's very, very moving. And if this could be replicated through all our inner city areas and throughout the world, it would certainly make a difference. But you know, you've started with the Middle East, where children are taught to hate. Children are taught to hate in many cultures. It isn't just the Middle East. That's just the extreme fanaticism, and it is only the fanaticism. It isn't Islam. It's the fanatical fringe of Islam. You get fanatical fringes in the Christian far right. You get fanatical fringes in Judaism. All of these great religions, which have so much in common, are being vilified because of the fanatical fringe elements. And because of that, you know, we're trying very hard to grow roots and shoots in the Middle East.
Have you?
Well, we're just starting a whole program in Iran, which is planning to reach out to the countries around the Caspian Sea, which includes Syria, includes Palestine, includes Iraq.
Do you think you will be any less successful there than you have been anywhere else?
No, I think once we can get our toeholds in. And unfortunately, Britain is besmirched in the same way as the United States in the eyes of many of these Islamic countries. So it's harder to get going. But if you have the right Islamic partner, and we do have, I mean, you know, we've got roots and shoots growing in Palestine slowly.
Do you want to go there yourself at some point?
At some point, I would really like to go there myself. We've got roots and shoots growing all over Israel. And I just see somehow that this is the way to the future.
So what would you like to see 15 years from now when you're on tour and someone who began with roots and shoots, it's like the Beatles, you know, now they're on tour and they're on their fourth generation of people mm-hmm. who have, what would you like to see? I presume it's like they coming to your lectures with their children.
And that happens already. People who read Shadow of Man when they were children, now bringing their children or even their grandchildren to my lectures.
So what would you like to see ultimately Roots and Shoots really do? I mean, that we can measure.
Well, we have this vision, don't we, of world peace, sustainable peace, which means not just laying down our weapons and stopping to fight over territory, but also learning to live in harmony with nature. So the vision is peace.
That's where we started, and you said it's a responsibility. If there isn't peace, it's not your fault, I suppose, but being a messenger of peace, do you think that, obviously you don't think it's an impossible task, but do you take that as, because we hear about these honors and we think, okay, this is just some honor that was given because she's a good woman or a good person. And it's like being a honorary board member kind of thing, you know. But you're really working at this, aren't you?
Well, the messenger of peace, because I have such high regard for the Secretary General and what he's trying to do, I will do every little thing in my power to promote peace. And also, I think it's terribly important. I mean, we all know the United Nations has flaws. We all know that it doesn't live up to the expectations of the people who built it after World War II. But at the same time, it's the only international platform where small countries can be heard. And so what I think we have to work really hard at doing is building up its credibility. And Kofi Annan is really trying to change the whole structure of the United Nations so that it will become more what we dream it could be. And we've got to help to create that organization. And that will be a big step towards sustainable peace.
Are you a little disappointed with the people who are leading this country at the moment? And if you could have 30 seconds to talk with the President of the United States, what would you tell him?
One of the major problems with the Bush administration is the way it has overturned almost every piece of legislation that was put into place in order to protect the environment, really since Rachel Carson published Silent Spring. And it's absolutely terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying, the laws that have been changed to now allow industry to create more pollution, for cities to allow pollution to go out into the rivers, for logging to be done in national forests, for roads to be built into wilderness areas, for snowmobiles to go back and destroy the fragile land. And I could go on and on and on and on and on. And it's an absolute disaster. And if I was sitting down with President Bush, I would need more than 30 seconds. And I would try and find a way. And you can't do this until you actually sit with someone. You can't. It's the African tradition. You don't start talking to somebody about something you're passionate about before you get the feeling. And you say, you know, how are you today? And how's your family? And So I couldn't do anything in 30 seconds. Nothing. I would need much longer, and I would try to find a crack into where there must be a sensibility inside there that does care about the future of the children of the world, that must care about his own grandchildren when he has them. There must be that little core that cares, and I would try and find a way to reach it and then say, but what you're doing is the opposite of the wisdom of the elders, which say every decision you make now, think about how that one decision will affect children 7 generations ahead.
How did you get so smart? I mean, you are maybe, arguably, one of the wisest women in the world, one of the most listened to, not only through your books, but through what you're saying. Is that the responsibility that you feel? Do you think I'm crazy for asking that question? But there are a lot of people, millions, who feel like I do, that Jane Goodall, or someone like Jane Goodall, whoever that might be, maybe should be ruling the world rather than politicians.
think a lot of people feel that politicians aren't the right people to be ruling the world, at least most politicians. But I think, you know, we've got to stop saying that. Who elects the politicians? And it's not until there's a groundswell of people who truly know where they're coming from and why they're voting the way they vote, and that they truly care passionately about the natural world and about peace, then when that groundswell of people, a tipping point if you like, reaches a mass that will elect the politicians who will then be able to live up to the expectations, because they want to be re-elected, and they won't be re-elected unless there's a mass of people to uphold them when they take the tough decisions, when they make something cost a little bit more because it's environmentally friendly or isn't made with child slave labor. So it isn't the politicians who are at fault, it's the great mass of the general public. And that's where my role is the educating and helping people to understand. And I just had the benefit of a very, very wise mother who had a wise mother. And so I was brought up to think things through, I think. And I've also had this amazing opportunity to be alone in nature, to sense this great spiritual power that I feel, and to feel in my bones that there is an intelligence guiding the universe, which is even now being proposed by the top physicists.
Do you think that intelligence in some way has spoken to you? I mean, you allude to it here and there in little bits in your books. I've never heard anyone come out and ask you. I'm sure people have. I am now.
Yes, I think it's the still small voice, and it is, especially when I'm alone in nature, but it doesn't have to be in nature. And it's really, it's not as though it's a voice speaking to you, but it's opening your heart as well as your mind to thoughts that seem to come in from elsewhere.
That voice doesn't sound like George Burns?
The voice doesn't sound like anything. It's just a feeling that comes into your heart, and then you can translate it magically into words.
Do you think most of us could have that if we opened up our hearts to it?
I know we could.